This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Deep in the imagination, there's a crossroads, a space where curiosity and inspiration intersect and give birth to ideas. A space where music, science fiction, comic books, and pop culture inform the mind of what is and what could be. This is Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. In each episode, legendary journalist Jeff Boucher welcomes the biggest names in genre entertainment for an expansive dive into all things pop culture. Journey with Jeff as he explores the latest news and recommendations of the hottest releases across entertainment with his most trusted confidants. You are now entering deep space. Heavy Metal presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space.
Hi, this is Jeff Boucher. Welcome to Mind Space. I'm here with Maya St. Clair, and we have a great show today. With the great Walter Simonson is going to join us. Readers of Marvel Comics will recognize that name instantly as one of the key creators from the Thor comics, the classic Beta Ray Bill comics, and so many other things, Star Slammers, and some movie comics as well that we're going to be talking about. And he's also part of a really cool project. And before we talk to Walt, we wanted to tell you guys a little bit about that project, which is coming from Zoop, who's a key new player in the comics field with crowd-funded projects with outstanding artists. And this one is that Walt's working on is for John Paul Leon's The Winter Men, which is a posthumous release for cult classic, and that's what this project's all about.
Yeah, it's available on Zoop. They've already blown the gates right off their crowdfunding goal, but you can still pre-order the book. It's going to be extremely high quality with lots of rare art by a plethora of artists in tribute to John Paul Leon, and the proceeds are all going to support the late artist's family. So it's a really wholesome project, and it puts you in amazing company. You can pre-order like the complete book. You can pre-order prints, signed prints by artists. We were going through them. It's got Bill Sienkiewicz, Lee Weeks, Sean Phillips, Kim Young-gi, who's going to be doing some stuff with Heavy Metal, but I can't tell you, but Dennis Cohen, and yeah, Walt and Joe Quesada, more. It looks absolutely stunning, and we'll have a link to it in the description.
Yeah, and those are and those names that you mentioned, some really great talents and some good people too. You know, some people that are well known for their the way they carry themselves in the industry. And Scott Dunbier is over at IDW for many years. He's the curating force behind this project, the editor, and he has such a great track record of doing really, really just archival quality retrospectives of some of the finest art accomplishments in comics. So I can't say enough about his work. So, and it sounds like a really good cause. I'm looking forward to reading The Winter Men myself. It's a Soviet era sort of super soldier setup. The book's 184 pages. It came out in a trade paperback version in 2009 that's very hard to find and goes for some crazy prices on Amazon for that reason. So this is a cult classic getting its due justice now.
Yeah, it looks super dark, gritty, and pretty thrilling. So
yeah, it looks like kind of like a Jason Bourne meets Winter Soldier meets Gorky Park.
Yeah, you can preview some of the art because Mr. Simonson has posted, you know, hints of it on his Twitter. So definitely check him out on Twitter. It's super wholesome.
Yeah, and it's pinups for this art edition that the guests are doing, the talented folks that we mentioned, and we talked to Walt about pinups or splash pages and using kind of unusual layouts and different things like that. It's today's conversation. It's a lot of stuff about the artist as a working professional. And I think always those conversations are always really interesting. I'm a big fan of Walt Simonson and Maya, you know, like when I was reading comics in the late 70s and 80s as a new reader, he and his wife, Louise Simonson, they were the married couple of Marvel Comics to me, like, and of comics in general. And I just thought that was so cool. And the fact that they have been married since 1980, I think is, I'm a hopeless romantic. So I think that that's very lovely. And that they have done some great stuff together. They most famously X-Factor, which is a Marvel brand that's probably got a bigger future for it because of all the stuff on screen that we're probably going to see coming in the years to come. But we should get to it. And so this is going to be Walter Simonson, one of the top comic book artists of this or any other era. And we're thrilled to have him here on Mindspace. Welcome to Mindspace. This week, I'm very excited. Maya and I welcome Walter Simonson. How are you, sir? Very, very excited to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I've enjoyed your work for so many years now. I have a very specific memory of when they first started doing Marvel graphic novels. And you had one of the very first ones.
I did, number six, I think.
Yeah, was it six? Oh, wow.
I think so. It should have been five, but I was so late that they that they took what was going to be two issues of the New Mutants. It was just starting. It was the first two issues. And they converted that to a graphic novel. So the New Mutants started as a graphic novel and came in a month before the Slammers came out.
I see. Oh, I didn't know that, but that makes sense. That it didn't feel like a graphic novel quite when that New Mutant story, reading it, it didn't feel like the other ones.
Right.
So that's interesting. But that must have been a big moment for you, especially what that project represented with the creator's rights and the format that Marvel gave it and the emphasis. It must have been a really shining moment for you.
It was fun. I mean, it was, you know, some of the stuff you do, you look back later and stuff seems more significant than it seemed at the time. At the time, hey, one more project, a check you can cash. So you're not quite thinking about, oh, this is a milestone. One thing I did like, and I was actually, it made it a little more familiar to me in a way, is that about a year or two earlier, a little more than that, maybe 2 years, 3 years earlier, Heavy Metal had put out a graphic novel adaptation of the Alien movie that I had drawn, Archie Goodwin had written, and they did it in a trade paperback format. It was square bound. I forget what you call that stuff now. But by the time the graphic novels of Marvel were starting to come out, that book had been out for a bit. Archie had gone to work for Marvel. And so they used the Alien graphic novel as a template for the Marvel graphic novels. That was where the format really came from.
Oh, no kidding. Wow, that's really interesting. You know, I did not know that. And I mean, Marvel had done, they had done like that Silver Surfer graphic novel in the, you know, in like the 70s. Like it was like a standalone, you know, Silver Surfer.
I'm sure there was. I mean, they tried different formats. You know, there were tabloid comics for a while. When I did the adaptation, I drew it with Archie on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And that actually came out in two formats. That came out in a magazine size format, and it came out in a larger tabloid size. So they were kind of casting around for different formats and trying to figure out what to do. I think comic shops weren't wild about the tabloids size because they weren't sure where they could put them on the shelves, apparently.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That was early days for comic book shops. That was very early days for that. So they were trying different things and continue to try different things from time to time. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. You know, in that era with those movie adaptations, that was such an interesting, you know, subset of what Marvel did, you know, doing, I remember obviously the Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and but also like Raiders of the Lost Ark it was interesting to see those in comic book form and see the actors portrayed in comic book art. Did you consider that a different type of challenge? Did you feel like you had to match the likenesses?
Well, catching likenesses is always difficult, at least for me. It's not impossible, but I mean, there are guys like John Bogdanov who just bat out likenesses like there's no tomorrow. It's really irritating. But, hey, John, if you're listening, I'm just telling you. But It also varies. Something that most of your readers don't know is that going back as far as Close Encounters, which is what, 78, 79, something like 78. That. The companies, Marvel or DC or anybody else, had to purchase the likeness rights as well as the license for doing the adaptation of the movie. And in the case of, for example, Close Encounters, Marvel did not have likeness rights, which is why nobody looks exactly like themselves. I tried to do physical types that were similar. To me, Richard Dreyfuss was a little on the blocky side, not a big guy, but a little blocky. And so I tried to do that somewhat in the character I drew. I think he wore flannel plaid shirts. I can't remember. I gave him a plaid shirt. So some of that stuff I tried to keep similar, but without being so close that they would start getting after me. Years later, I did a project with Frank Miller. Frank wrote it. I drew it, RoboCop versus the Terminator.
Oh, and yeah.
Dark Horse published it. They did not have the likeness rights for Peter Weller. So I hope they don't sue me now. I kind of drew Peter Weller. As I said, I'm not a real strong likeness guy. So I didn't try to make it look exactly like Weller, but I tried to get something similar enough that it would be, you know, readers wouldn't be too far off of it. The funny thing was there was one drawing at the end of that book, the fourth issue, where the character is back to being human again for a kind of a hallucination, I think. And he's screaming. And screaming faces are, they're difficult to draw, and they're difficult to draw with a likeness. Unless you've got good reference, it's tough to do a real screaming face and still make it look like the guy. And so that's probably the face in that book that least looks like Peter Weller, any face I did. And that's the face they came back and wanted changes on. I went, really, this face? I thought, I don't think Peter Weller looks like this, but I, you know, that was okay.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've interviewed him a couple times and he's a screamer. Like he starts screaming during the interview. So maybe that's why. Maybe it just.
I've never met Peter Weller. I don't know anything about him in real life. I hope he's not pissed that I sort of, you know, fudged my likenesses. But
he'll find you if he's
very funny.
He'll come find you if he is. Don't worry.
I'm sure.
He's a real character and a very much a Renaissance man. You know, he teaches like Renaissance and a Renaissance art class at USC.
Wow, good for him.
I might be mangling the exact name or discipline, but I know it's in the arts and I know it's in the antiquities. Right. I interviewed him in LA on stage once in front of like just a couple hundred people, and he started literally screaming during the interview, talking about he got very animated and melodramatic, theatrical on purpose. Criticizing Denzel Washington and other actors who drive but never look where they're driving in movies. That's his big
pet peeve. How funny.
And he went off. It's on YouTube. If you ever have 4 minutes of your life and just want to know what Weller looks like when he's screaming, to hold it up against your art, that would be the
go. I'll have to go take a look. That's very funny. We ran into a problem once when I was doing, drew Battlestar Galactica back in about 79 when it came out. And Marvel did not have likeness rights. And I went into the guys anyway. I drew the characters anyway, more or less, again, without being too close, but just in the style I used. And the Glenn Larson Productions or whoever it was putting that thing out, whoever we had to go through, came back. My wife, 79, my girlfriend at the time, I did that while we were getting married. So she may have been my wife by that time. But Louise got word from the licensor that Apollo looked too much like himself, which was Richard Hatch. Yeah. And looked a little like Richard Hatch. Okay. And there was some panel they were concerned about. So
it looked like Bruce Jenner. I remember it.
We kind of sat around for a bit, and then we got back and said, okay, how's this? Now, we hadn't changed anything. And they said, all right, that's fine. And then somewhere in there, we discovered that they hadn't actually met Apollo. They had met Adama. They'd met Lauren Green.
Oh, wow.
Whom we never touched because we didn't think that was the guy they were talking about. So they, you know, I did think as a writer, at the time, I did write a few of those issues, my very first writing in comics, but I was only a fledgling writer. But I did think anyway that having two main characters whose names began with A was maybe not the smartest choice to make with characters in a limited cast. I thought, well, maybe it could have been Apollo and, you know, William or something completely different.
But, for sure.
And I thought, even they can't keep it straight. I'm not really too worried about it. So that was funny. It was a fun book. That licensing back then for the comic book end of it was very free and easy. Now it's way, you know, it's all likeness rights. It's guys really leaning on you to make sure the drawings are what they think they look like. And there's not much fun in it for me. It's mostly, back then it was fun. There wasn't a lot of oversight. Alien was maybe the best adaptation I did with Archie. And that one, we had three different script versions to work from. Nobody cared what we did. We basically tried to put all three together in a way that would make the best story in a 64-page comic or whatever the book was. So, but we found that as time went by, they began leaning on you more and more. When Roy did the first Star Wars. Archie wrote the second Star Wars, Roy Thomas. And he wrote the third one. And by the third one, there were scenes he was told to omit because they would reveal too much of what was going on. And some of them, of course, were crucial scenes. So if anybody could write around that stuff, it was Archie. But before that, you know, up until somewhere in that neck of the woods, you really had a pretty free hand they would come back and they would, I wrote the adaptation for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And they came back a couple times they wanted some line changed. I don't remember them now. And there was one bit that was real, I forgot, I haven't seen the movie in a long time now. There was a bit in the beginning where Indy is after the very opening where he's getting that little golden idol out of the cave and he switches it with the rock, bag of rocks or whatever it was, and runs out and the big boulder comes after him. And one of the natives, I think, had grabbed it and run off with it. When he had to swing across a chasm or something. And in the end, well, in the original script, I think Indy may have, I don't know if he killed the guy. I think in the movie, it's not like they find all these arrows at him, I think from other natives, something like that. But in the original version of the comic, Indy may have killed him in some way.
The guy that betrays him on the way in that gets killed by the trap with all
the guy who betrayed him. I don't remember exactly now, but what happens is in the comic, they came back and said, no, can't do this. I guess they might be killing somebody deliberately, which I get, but that's whatever it was what was in the script originally. John Buscema drew it. And so it was very late, had to go out to the printer. So there was some fudging done in production. And the fudging was that Indy, he had thrown his whip and spun it, had wrapped around the guy, and the guy had a gun. So I'm remembering it. Anyway, somehow the gun pops out and shoots him. So it doesn't Indy didn't really do it. And what there is a little, I think there's a little drawing of a gun, a little silhouette that was stuck in one panel. And there was one panel where the guy's running off, maybe he didn't get killed. And so there's a little silhouette, it looks like a cartoon silhouette of somebody kind of running along, you know, doing the hokey pokey, getting off. It's a little tiny drawing of the guy. So you could write, oh, look, he got away, or he got shot, whatever happened to him, I don't remember. But they had to fudge that a little bit because they changed what had been in the script originally to a different idea, and we had to accommodate that.
Yeah.
That stuff was just fun. It was just, that was not a big deal. Later it became more, and when you're really working on the likeness rights and likenesses, my feeling is as an artist, a lot of my energy then has to go into trying to get these faces right and getting approvals. Sure. And the energy I put into that stuff is energy that's not going into telling a good story and trying to do the best comic book I can do. And really, my job is to do a good comic book. It's not to make, you know, some, you know, Joe Schmo look exactly like Joe Schmo so Joe Schmo will be happy. I don't really care. So that's why I'm not doing movie adaptations anymore.
You know, I remember the... talking about either where the adaptations diverge or when things have to be kind of fudged. I have a very distinct memory of the Empire Strikes Back adaptation and the purple Yoda, that there was a skinny, thin, purple, purple-skinned Yoda, and I guess it was before they had either completed or made available the finished, you know, Yoda likeness, because he looked much more like something that he looked kind of Middle Earth-ish. He looked right. like he could have right. been hanging out with Gollum.
It's also possible. I mean, yeah, they might have gotten the finished color on it, but I know for Indiana Jones, for the Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Lucasfilm folks or whoever was doing that, I guess that was through Spielberg. I don't know how that, I don't remember the company.
That's right.
But they sent black and white photos. So they were like 8x10 glossies or whatever they were. They were not color. So whoever was doing it at the time probably had no color reference to begin with. What was also true in those photos, I don't know how I ever saw it, you'd have a photo and it'd be a shot of Indy with his face, you know, he'd be running in the village, in the village or through the jungle, whatever. And somebody had gone through and taken a very narrow little router that was about a 16th of an inch wide, a little less than that maybe. And they had run a vertical line right over the photograph to destroy the emulsion, and a horizontal line the same way right through his face.
Uh-huh.
So the lines crossed in the middle of the important of the face, presumably so you couldn't sell it to Time magazine and walk away the fortune and reveal stuff in the movie. But sure. I mean, for the kind of stuff we were doing, it didn't really matter. John Buscema drew that. John could draw anything, including yeah. likenesses. So it didn't slow him down, but it yeah. was kind of funny at the time. And they yeah. were, but they were black and white. That's not always true. And maybe these days, maybe you'd never get black and white. I don't know. But back then it probably didn't have any color reference on Yoda, or they may not have decided what to do with him at the film company, and they hadn't, so the decision didn't come through by the time the book had to be on press.
Yeah, it's fascinating just because the timing of the adaptations back then and all the pent up interest in those movies, you know, so I remember like going over them intensely, looking for clues about the, you know, the films that were coming or, but that such an interesting chapter in time. And then for you, you know, obviously the Thor years just must have been a wonderful time for you, and just as a storyteller, not just in your art's very, very graceful, but your storytelling really just went up so many notches on people's radar. When you look back on that, how do you kind of look back on that success at this time?
I'm delighted. I mean, again, you know, I was doing it while Chris was and John Byrne and Paul Smith doing the X-Men. Frank right. was doing, getting wrapping up Daredevil somewhere in there. Dave Michelinie and Bob Layton were doing Iron Man. So there were some really good comics coming out of Marvel at the time. Yeah. And, you know, so you were kind of just part of that pack in a way. You know, one of my early friends in comics was Bernie Wrightson. So anything Bernie did was just light years ahead of all the rest of us. So it was just like, you know, you're just doing comics. I was thrilled to do Thor. I was an old Norse myth fan from long when I was a child. So it was great to discover a comic. I was in college when I found Thor, and was delighted to discover there was a comic about the Norse myths, more or less.
Yeah.
And I wrote some of my own stuff. I wrote some fan stuff, not ever published, but that became the basis for my Surtur story 14 years after I'd put it together when I got the book. I have a lot of credit. I have to give a lot of credit to the late Mark Grunewald. Mark was my editor. He was the guy who originally offered me the gig on Thor. The story I got at the time, I've never really confirmed it, so I don't know if this is true. I've heard that the book wasn't selling very well. I mean, generally freelancers were not privy to the sales figures from the companies, except in the postal regulations where once a year they put stuff in there. I was told a lot of that stuff was fiction. I don't know if that's yeah. true or not either.
Yeah.
But basically, in theory, the book wasn't doing well. And Mark Grunewald, when he offered me the book as writer, and I had written the three issues of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I had written four issues, which is adaptation. I'd written four issues of Battlestar Galactica, and I'd written a graphic novel about the Star Slammers. It was roughly three issues long. So what is that, eight? Three and four, seven, eight, nine. About 10 issues of comics yeah. by the time I started doing Thor. So I really was a kind of a brand new writer. Mark, I think because the book wasn't doing well, when he gave me the book, he offered it to me with carte blanche. He said, you can do whatever you want. He gave me a list of things. He typed up a list, which I cannot find. I haven't seen it in a million years. I would give a nickel to have it again so yeah. I could see what he suggested. But none of them were things he wanted done. They were just things to suggest to me or to show me that anything was possible. I could probably have, I could have killed Thor off and given somebody else the hammer. Well, I didn't give somebody else the hammer. I didn't kill Thor. But stuff like that, which in 1983 really hadn't been done.
Which what you were doing.
You know, a lot of that's been done since, but not so much then. And
to make him a frog. I mean, that's very, that's more than killing him, really. I mean, that's actually more outlandish. Everybody gets killed in comics. Nobody gets turned into a frog.
I'm amazed, and I there's no other way to say this. I'm amazed that frog has legs. There's just no other way to put it. But I'm stunned. I mean, the frog character, Throg, isn't the same as mine. I mean, he was based on it. It's a different character, really, from out of my stories. But just the idea that the Thor frog even exists anymore, and that there are stories, there are sculptures of it, there are manquettes or whatever those things are called, little busts, and the, I guess there's a Lego out now, maybe a little Lego figure. I have to go look for one of those. But I'm stunned. You know, you do it, especially back in those days, there weren't a lot of reprints. That was just starting to come up, but not a lot yet, and very few collections. So mostly you did the comics. You never expected to see them again in print. You thought they'd come out, they'd be on the spinner rack for a month or in the comic shop, and they'd be in, you know, your mom's basement where you sold your back issues from, stuff like that, but you didn't really expect to see them again. And to be here all these years later, like almost not quite 40 years later, and that stuff's still floating around, it's still in print, much of it, it's or off and on. There are other things that have spun out of it. It's kind of amazing. And again, at the time you're doing it, especially I was writing pencil and inking, I was always a little on the late side of that stuff. They kept kind of moving my schedule for me. Thank you, Howard, if you're out there, Mike Carlin, Mark Grunewald, Ralph Macchio, to kind of make sure the book came out consecutively without too much of a break. And when you're doing all that stuff, that's a lot of work in a given month. So I wasn't thinking a lot about, you know, you don't do that stuff thinking about legacy. Maybe people do now. I don't know. It's never been one of my considerations. And especially back then, most of you just trying to make a living out of it. So you don't consider, you know, there was no legacy back then in a sense. There'd be a few comic fans who would know the old stuff, but it wasn't like you could walk into a comic shop or a Barnes & Noble and find trade paperbacks of this work. So that was never a consideration at the time. In fact, in the early 70s, when I was gotten into business, my pals Howard Chaykin and Ellen Milgram and Jim Starlin, a whole bunch of us would hang around. Many of us, Howard and I especially, thought that comics, I'm sure others as well, were really a dying business. There were fewer sales every month. You could kind of see it trending down. And we all got into comics because we loved it. We wanted to do them. And we wanted to do them while they still existed.
Yeah.
And we thought, okay, 10 years from now, we're going to have to find real jobs. Yeah. But for right now, we're doing comics.
It's like being a Dixieland musician. Like, and it turned out, let's do this while we can.
Yep. It turned out, I mean, with the birth of the direct market, comic sales jacked up. They did not die. We may need, now we're in another, maybe in a period of transition now between floppies, the monthly books, and collections, and where you're doing larger slabs of comics. I don't know. That's kind of beyond my ken. But mostly it was a business that we loved and wanted to be part of while we could. So again, you weren't thinking very much about legacy. You were mostly thinking, man, I just love doing this stuff and I'll just do it until I have to go find a real job someplace.
Yeah. Yeah. And what an exciting time, as you said. I mean, the peers that you mentioned, you know, you just cited off some people, and I know that you shared studio spaces at different times with people like Frank and
Frank and Howard, Jim Sherman,
and Val.
Val Merrick, with the guys in my studio, rotating through. We usually had three to four guys in the studio at one time.
Yeah.
And it was, well, Weezy and I talk about that. My wife and I talk about that once in a while. Is that the 70s and the 80s, in a way, up to maybe about 1990, were a great time to be doing comics because there was so much freedom in the work. Like I said, with Thor, I really had carte blanche. When I suggested the Thor, turning Thor into a frog, nobody blanched. Nobody went, oh no, don't do it. They just, you know, it was, Simonson's off on one of his loony, you know, storylines. I think the only story I really kind of vetted in advance with Jim Shooter, who was the editor in chief at Marvel. And I think during almost my entire time on Thor, maybe my entire time on Thor, right? I'm not sure. Yeah. But I wanted to do an issue that was all splash pages. It was right at the end of my run, like my 380. And I finished up at 382. And I wanted to do an all splash page issue. John Byrne had done an all splash page issue of the Hulk, which had not come out in the Hulk magazine. Eventually it was put out in Marvel Fanfare. I do not remember if it had come out by the time I did the Mjolnir song issue or not. I kind of think not. I had not seen it, but we all heard about it. So I knew that, you know, I don't claim any credit for originating the idea. And there's an old Partridge Family comic that's mostly pinups.
That's great.
You know, a big shot of David Cassidy and a big shot of whoever the other actors and actresses were. I don't think every page is a splash, but a lot of them are. They're really just done as pinups for kids. So the idea was kind of floating around. I had the idea when I was doing Thor, because I was working up to having Thor fight the Midgard serpent. In the Norse myths, the Midgard serpent, Jormungandr, encircles the world. He lies under the ocean and he encircles the world. He's that big. And so when Thor fights him in the end, they fight at Ragnarok. It's the final battle for both of them. Both of them die as a result of that battle. And I wanted to do a version of that story without entirely killing Thor, since I wanted to be able to pay my mortgage the following month. But I worked out a way to do it. I had a lot of trouble for a while thinking about it, trying to decide how to draw it. Part of the problem is that, and I do this to myself all the time as a writer, it's very annoying. Thor is, you know, compared to a serpent who's this encircles the world, Thor is pretty small.
Yeah.
So there was a big problem of scale trying to get Thor and a world serpent. In the end, I made Jormungand's head really large, but not so large that I couldn't kind of work it out in panels with Thor. And the body trails off over the horizon and disappears, presumably into the ocean for a long way. I debated about doing, and I also wanted to make it kind of an epic feeling story. And I felt that if I did a lot of, I mean, I was thinking about it, you know, small panels, well, Jormungand's head will be big, but then Thor will be the size of, like, you know, my 16th of an inch. And yeah. If I have close-ups on Thor, you'll see like a, you know, part of a tooth from Jormungand. And there'd be ways to fudge it, but for a whole comic, it'd be kind of tiresome. And sure. I thought, well, I could do a couple of pages, and then I'll have some subplot running, and we'll cut to the subplot for a page, then back to the fight, because the subplot introduces an element of time that makes the fight seem longer. So that'd be one way of making the fight seem like it took up more time, by having these other elements interrupting it as you're going along, so you have to come back to it, and you can figure they've been fighting for the time you were away from them. That was another possible solution, and I just couldn't really get a hold of it. I was thinking about this months before I did the issue. Eventually, we used to live on the west side of Manhattan, and it was a little restaurant called the Cantina that we loved, the Mexican restaurant, on 71st and Columbus, on the northeast corner. And we used to go there once or twice a week easily. And we were there one night, it was a summer night, because it was warm outside and it was still daylight. And we finished up eating about 7 o'clock. I can remember this, I mean, most of my life I cannot remember like this, I trust me. There will not be an autobiography of my life because I have no idea what I've done.
But it'll be all splash pages.
It'll be all splash pages, absolutely. So maybe I'll make you my writer, you can be my ghost. So we were stepping, literally walking out of the restaurant, and I walked across the threshold. As I walked across the threshold out into the summer night about 7 o'clock, I suddenly went, all splash pages.
Nice.
It could be all splash pages. And it's one of the only times it did feel like a light bulb went off over my head. Most of the ideas, you have to pound them out. You hammer them and you work at them and you temper them and you eventually get them. In that case, it was just like, bang, the whole idea came to me. And I thought, now you're still gonna go through 22 pages in a big hurry if it's nothing but 22 panels. But I thought that what I could do was it'd be some captions to follow along in the story as well as dialogue. And the captions I decided to write in kind of a faux Norse poetry. The advantage, well, for me, poetry, I can't read poetry like prose. I have to almost read it out loud. I have to read it slowly. Prose I can kind of bomb right through. So, but you miss so much in poetry, even if it's not long, you miss so much trying to read it that way. So, and also the good thing about that was that Norse poetry at least the stuff I knew from the Elder Edda and other places, it wasn't rhymed. So you weren't going to end up with like a limerick. There was an old man from Nantucket who's, you know, it wasn't going to sound like
that. I know that one. Okay.
Well, many people know that one. But I thought it's stressed syllables. That's the opening. It's the first syllable in seven words that are stressed that you kind of put through the lines in a particular way. And even if I wrote really bad poetry, which I think I did, you would have to slow down to read it. Right. And that would slow your advance. If you actually read it, I mean, a lot of people I'm sure went flip, 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 and that was it. But if you're going to read it, you have to read it, dialogue, flip it, read it, dialogue, flip it. And so that would slow people down. And going back to Jim Shooter, I was concerned about doing all splash pages. I didn't know if he would be in favor of that. And so one day, and this is back in the day, you could stop in anybody's office. I mean, now you have to have an appointment to get into an office, you know, into the DC office, the Marvel office, whatever it is. And you have, you know, post 9/11. And you kind of make your appointment to the editor. Back then, you just showed up.
Yeah.
And if they knew who you were, which, you know, all the freelancers knew the folks there, you just were waved on in, and then you could walk around the office and bother people, you know, keep editors from doing their work. Nice. And so you could pop into offices, see friends, other freelancers would be there, editors that you knew. It was really very much a social set as well as an editorial office, which at the time, again, great time to be doing comics. So. Yeah. I stopped by Jim's office. His door was open. He wasn't, if he'd been busy, I wouldn't have done it, but his door was open. He was in there by himself. So I popped in and I explained to Jim what I wanted. I had an idea I thought was great, but it was going to be doing this issue of Thor with Jormungand in all splash pages. And Jim was fine with it. Now, whether he would have been fine if he'd been surprised by it when it got into print, I don't know. I'm sure he would have been. But in any case, talking to him in advance gave me kind of the imprimatur to go ahead and do it and not be worried about it. Hmm. And that was, that was good. That was a good way to create it. So Ralph Macchia was my editor by that time. And Ralph was pretty much fine with whatever I was doing. So it was good to, but I thought it was good to kind of clear that one because it was a little unusual for the time. And
I remember the issue.
Worked out well.
Yeah, it worked out terrific. And there's a real operatic.
Well, it's pretty big.
What's that?
It's pretty big.
It
has that big opera quality. So so that was fun. And I also, Jim very kindly let me do something that they didn't like people doing, which is I did that in 24 pages instead of 22. And that meant, now I did a few, but my very first issue, I think was 23. I did an extra page there. We may have dropped the letter column, which they let you do once in a while. And then, but I think for the 24 pages, we might have had to drop the bullpen bulletin as well. And that they didn't like that because that's, of course, a lot of promotion for other comics that month. So they weren't crazy about that. But Jim let me do it for that issue, for which, again, I'm very grateful because it just gave me a little more elbow room to do my story. And I in a place where I thought it made a difference. The few extra pages just gave me a little more space in which to tell that story when it was really just like, you know, one big panel after another.
You know, the way that you were talking about scale and approaching that and going through that process, it made me think a little bit about some of the things that Kirby did with like 2001 adaptation or some of the FF stuff, Fantastic Four stuff he did that had he would have interstitial like photographs, outer space and different things that
did collages and stuff. He did some phenomenal stuff that were, you know, the only thing that was bad about those was the reproduction was so crappy back in the
day.
Like so awful. And I just thought, man, I wish this were on good paper. And, you know, they would half tone them and the half tones would print kind of not great on that new crappy newsprint. But it was really exciting. It was really Ego of the Living Planet. He's sitting there with all this photographic crap around him and stuff. And it was really neat. I really, you know, Jack experimented a lot, really, for a guy who was putting out 8 million comics a minute.
Yeah.
At the time to just think about this stuff at some level that most of the rest of us, maybe all of us, just never achieved. It was just.
Yeah. I was always fascinated by the fact of he was such a patriotic and such a kind of tradition of his generation and then had this fantastical side. Like it was almost like he, like Archie Bunker and Zappa put together. Like it was the strangest, thing.
Jack at all. Well, I met him several times, mostly for like 3 seconds at a convention. I did meet him once. It might have been his last New York appearance, whatever convention that would have been, late '70s maybe or thereabouts. And we had a chance to talk for about 5 or 10 minutes after some panel, which was great. I do not remember at all what I talked about. I'm sure I didn't say much, and it had Jack was talking about stuff, and I'm sure that's how it went. But he really, you know, he was such a, he came home from the war, sounds like he married his sweetheart, you know, got a job. But what he, I have a sister-in-law whose father was a World War II vet. He served in the 10th Mountain in Italy. Never heard his war stories. That's okay. Okay. They must have been rugged. He loved skiing. So he was the right guy in the right job at the time. But he came home from the war and married his sweetheart. Went to work for John Deere out in the Midwest. It was a pattern maker maybe. And you know, did the American dream of that generation, where he worked his whole life for the company, retired. Yeah. I presume he had whatever kind of pension he had. And you know, it was the American dream of that, the greatest generation. And in a way, except the fact that Jack went off and did these astounding comic books that were mind-boggling, kind of the same story. He really, you know, he kind of lived an American dream, but in an area of creation that most Americans don't get into at all.
So, absolutely.
Pretty astounding, really. Just it's like, it seemed like such a, well, both a down-to-earth guy and a complete spacehead.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like it's Frank Capra meets H.P. Lovecraft. Like what? Like how did you do that? How can you be that?
I don't know. We all aspire to that.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you're doing now. And I know you have there's all these different ways of changing the space between the artist and the audience these days in comics and storytelling in general. That the way that people get things and the way that they consume them, the way that they interact, all that's up in the air and changing. And some of it's very exciting, some of it's kind of off-putting. But for you right now, tell me a little bit about where you're at with your ongoing conversation with your work and your fans.
I'm a really boring old guy. I'm a dull guy. I have younger friends who are doing all this stuff on the web. They're doing all this stuff through Kickstarter. They're doing stuff through other, you know, independent companies. I am actually at that independent company through IDW right now, the comic I'm doing. I haven't done, and some of my comics are available through Comixology, although a lot of that would be the older work that, you know, Marvel or DC is putting up there. I don't have anything to do with that. That stuff goes up and I get a royalty of like 25 cents, 14 cents, 35 cents. You know, it adds up after a while.
Sure.
Mostly, I am a traditionalist. I'm a guy that I still work physically. I haven't learned to work with a computer. I mean, I do stuff like this, obviously. And the one thing I can do with a computer now, which makes my life easier in comics, is I can correct typos. So I can use Photoshop, which is like using a nuclear weapon to break nuts. I mean, it's just like really Photoshop, so you can change like an R to an F. You know, well, yes. So I used to have to do all this stuff by hand. But now I was able to imitate John Workman's lettering fairly well if I needed to, but it was still tough. You're sitting there, you know, really trying to get that shape. So when it gets reduced, you won't be able to tell. And now with Photoshop, I've changed whole words and balloons and all sorts of stuff. I try to get it right the first time. There are a lot of writers now who, I think in the digital age, lettering is mostly is digital now. I try to avoid that as much as possible. Work I do for Marvel or DC, sometimes it's digital, sometimes it's on the boards. I prefer on the boards because I can accommodate the balloon shapes to my art, or I can accommodate my art to the balloon shapes. If it's digital, it still looks to me largely like stuff laid down on top of the panel, because that's what it is in a virtual fashion. So I would rather get the balloons down and adjust my art to make that, because the shape of the balloon is such a positive shape inside the panel. It's such a graphic shape that's part of the art, really. And so I don't want that to be a kind of a random thing tossed down. It doesn't have to be. I'm sure there are digital letterers who can take that into account. I did a comic years ago for CrossGen. It was a fill-in. Ron, you know,
Friends?
I get them confused and I hate myself for it. There's Ron Friends and Ron Mars, and one of them is an artist and one of them is a writer.
Friends is the Silver Surfer.
Friends is the writer.
I think he's
See, this is my problem. And I know both of them, and it's really terrible. But
I think Mars is the writer.
Was, but I wasn't dead certain. So sorry, yeah. Ron. I know you're gonna hear this and gonna
You know what? We can it's a walnut we can drop an A-bomb on. Don't worry.
But Ron Mars, he was doing a book, it was a samurai book that Bart Sears was drawing. Oh, I can't remember the name of it now. But the they did a fill-in for issue 5. And part of the conceit of the book was kind of a fictional world in Japan, a feudal world of the samurais and stuff in Japan. And there was a war going on, and the hero's best friend was a Viking. He had wandered over to Japan from Scandinavia, survived the trip, and was part of the crew with the hero. So the story I did, Ron wrote a specific story so that it'd be an origin story for this guy. So he could have the war leading up to a certain spot, had this origin story, and then have the war with Bart doing the artwork again. And I drew it, and I thought about it, and I thought, I like doing this kind of weird stuff. There's not any Viking drawing anywhere that I know of anyway. There's not a lot of stuff. They did, you know, the writing they left is really inscriptions. It's not really manuscripts. It's the Firthark, and it's not, you don't have old manuscripts of Viking stuff. And you have holes in the ground where buildings used to be, and you kind of interpret how those like look like. So what there is, the Normans in France were Norsemen. They were descendants of the Vikings, not only a couple generations removed, I think. And so when William the Conqueror invaded England in 1066 and won and killed King Harold and took over, became the king in England, there was a big tapestry made called the Bayeux Tapestry. It's a couple of hundred feet long. One end of it's destroyed, so it was longer than that originally. But it's like a big comic strip that tells the story of the meeting of these two sides, the confluence of history, and the battles, the death of King Harold, and the victory of William the Conqueror. Now, it is told from the victor's point of view, so it's all that.
Usually is.
There are Latin inscriptions, you know, a few words scattered through the tapestry to explain stuff here and there. Not really word balloons, but nevertheless, words and pictures combined. So when Wolf tells his story, the comic opens up with about maybe 4 or 5 pages of Wolf and his friend, whose name I don't remember either, talking. And then there's a close of the same sort of thing. But the middle is all Wolf telling his story. So at the time, CrossGen was doing all double page spreads. They were actually producing paper that was a double page spread where the paper, you didn't have to tape paper together to make a double page spread. You got a sheet that was a double page spread size for drawing. So I got a bunch of that stuff. So in the middle section where Wolf's telling a story, I did it all as double page spreads, and I borrowed the Bayeux Tapestry style. So I didn't do it. I did 3 rows on each page, separated by little decorative borders taken again from the tapestry. So you could read across and then read across and then read across, flip it over, and then have the same thing. And I drew it as close as I could to the Bayeux Tapestry style. And the ships from the Bayeux Tapestry are dragon boats. They're like dragon ships from the Vikings. So it's pretty close enough for rock and roll. And I will say, whoever lettered that, there's stuff, captions in the, you know, Wolf's narration. And I've forgotten the type they chose. They chose kind of a Viking, a runic-like type. And they dropped it in very carefully, really carefully around the art. So it looks like it's part of the art. I don't remember who lettered it. Thank you very much, whoever you are out there. I'm very grateful. But it worked out very nicely. And I was really happy. And in that particular strip, I did the opening, the first half of the Bayeux Tapestry stuff with a pen, a little harder line. And then the second half of it, I all inked in brush, like Japanese brush lettering. Nobody can tell the difference, even in good reproduction. You'll never know the difference. But I did do that to give it a little bit different feel. And my favorite review was some guy who reviewed it on the web and said, wow, read this book. Walt Simonson's drawing has really gone to hell.
That's funny.
On the other hand, somebody apparently in production at CrossGen down in Florida, when the art came in, said, "Oh my God, he's doing the Bayou Tapestry."
So, oh my gosh. Wow.
He totally got it. Good for that guy.
That's funny.
That's what I enjoy. I enjoy that kind of thing, trying to find ways to tell a story that derive from the story itself. Yeah. And I don't go nuts every issue by any means, but some issues lend themselves to a different stylistic approach.
Yeah, and the form becomes part of the expression, like in a really interesting way. I was going to ask you if the panels were consistent, and when you did the triple stacked, were the panels consistent size all the way through?
I didn't do panels. I did a continuous thread, the same way the tapestry is done.
I see.
It'd be an image, and then an image, and then an image, but no actual break between them.
Yeah. I had a kind of a philosophical question for you, real quick.
I will say one real quick thing. Out of the stylistic approach, trying to figure out some way to do stuff. As you know, there's going to be this book of John Paul's Wintermen coming out. And the guys doing it asked several people to do pinups for it, John Paul's friends and colleagues. I did one of those. I will confess here on the air, I've never read The Wintermen. I've looked at the art. I've loved it. I want to read it someday, but I think I missed some of the issues when they came out and never got around to buying the collection. The collection is still available. It's not available. It's used and on the web. I found a copy that wasn't $1 million. It's on order. So it hasn't shown up yet. But I know John Paul's work, and Tommy Lee Edwards, who's one of the guys spearheading this, sent me a PDF of John Paul's work in the book. There were about 3 or 4 complete pages, a couple of covers, a bunch of character designs, which is just a thrill to see because you never see that stuff. Yeah. And one of the character designs, there were 3 actually, of somebody called a Rocket Man. So the Rocket Men, who are, I gather, armored Russian troops from this world that the Wintermen occurs in. And I thought they looked really cool. I took the version I really liked, and I drew a pinup of that guy, and then some smaller guys either side, and then a shot behind them of St. Basil's in Red Square to indicate this is like Russian stuff. So I hope I never have to draw that building again. It's gorgeous, but it was really a pain in the neck to draw. So when I got ready to ink it, I talked to Tommy there, I emailed him really. And I asked what John Paul had used, because John Paul, I taught him in class many years ago. He was in my class at School of Visual Arts. I had nothing to do with his talent. I did nothing other than not trammel him, I think is what I did. But I think he used he was doing mostly pencils for me at the time, but he used pens. And Tommy Lee, turns out he'd use like things like Pigma markers and stuff like that, and a lot of other stuff. They're kind of like, thin point magic markers. They're archival, which is important. In the old days, Pentels and stuff were really cool to work with, but they were not permanent. And so you get old Alex Toth drawings, the line will turn to red or brown, and almost be faded out completely in some cases. Oh, wow. So they weren't really designed to last forever the way, India ink will last way longer than I'm going to. So the Pigma markers in theory should. So I inked that drawing with Pigma markers, which I haven't never done that before. Well, I thought it'd be appropriate. And I did used to use rapidographs, the tactical pens, a million years ago. Right. And this is not unlike that. The pens themselves, the Pigma markers, have one size. Well, they come in different size points, but the points are not flexible. A little felt tip, you can do something with it, but not much. They aren't like using a Quill pen or a brush where you can really vary the line width. You draw a line, it's that same thickness all the way through. So you use different pens to achieve different line weights, and you kind of view the work a little differently in the way you're trying to get to your graphic look in the drawing. And I'm doing a New Mutants story right now for Marvel and drawing it that my wife wrote. For X-Men Legends, number 11, I think. And it's almost, not quite, I've still got a ways to, I've got about a little over, well, less than half to go, actually, about a third to go, the pencil, and then I'm gonna start inking it. And I had so much fun inking John Paul's drawing, or the drawing for John Paul, that I've decided, pretty close to decided, I'm gonna try a couple of panels first. If they don't work out, I can go back to what I'm used to doing. I think I'm going to ink this job with Pigma markers. Now, a lot of young guys, we talked earlier about what people do these days. a lot of younger artists who are not working digitally do use Pigma markers and other kinds of markers to ink their work. I don't see a lot of that. One of the advantages in the old days was that when you went into the office, you could just walk in, talk to people. You ran into a lot of freelancers who brought their work in. So you could see the original work they were doing. Now, most of them back then were still using pens and India ink and brushes. Not all of them, a few. Gil Kane used a lot of early marker stuff. Alex Stoth, I remember being at DC my first year in comics. I've said this story before. Alex did a really beautiful job on a book, a story that Archie Goodwin wrote for him, particularly, called Burma Skies, which is or Burma Sky, I forget which one, which is a World War II story of fighter planes and bombers and stuff. And the art came in, and it was astounding. It was astounding. And I got to sit there and hold the art in my hands. And that's something, I mean, almost nobody can do that anymore. It all goes in digitally. It's all sitting around people's houses. I mean, you can find the dealers and look at it there, but it's not the same. Back then, you were in the office once or twice a week. You had to take your own work in order for them to collect it and photograph it and proof it and all the rest of that stuff. So if you bumped into Gil Kane, you bumped into Howard Chaykin, you bumped into Jim Starlin, you bumped into Alan Milgram bringing in inked work, or you bumped into whoever, they'd have work with them. You could look at the stuff they were doing. That's how I know in the old days, Jim Starlin, don't know about now, Jim used to groove his pages with a pencil incredibly deeply. And I always thought, man, if there were only, he really penciled hard. And I thought, if only there was some way to pour India ink across this page and then wipe it off, it would all be there. It would, all the lines would just fill in and it would just be, it would be perfect.
Yeah,
of course. But you learned that stuff to see what other people were doing. You saw their techniques. Now you get some on, you know, people that show demonstrations on YouTube. You'll see friends at conventions, but it's in a way, it doesn't seem to me to be quite the intense education of looking at art in the 1970s, 1980s. The one thing that made that time for me so priceless, to be able to do that kind of stuff in hand. So anyway, I'm going to try, I'll take a crack at inking this with Pigma markers. If I do a couple of panels and they suck, well, I'll scatter them through the job so they won't show up too much when I go back to using my regular tools. Well, we'll see how that works.
That's great. You know, it's interesting. I've been a journalist since I was 17, and in newsrooms. And the way you were talking about Marvel reminds me of newsrooms, and the way that you're talking about looking under the hood of other people's art in person reminds me of the lessons I got, you know, in watching journalists who were much more accomplished and experienced than I was.
Are there still newsrooms where people gather like that?
No.
Is it more virtual stuff now?
Yeah, everything's virtual, and I think it makes me concerned about sort of institutional amnesia or just a sort of a general lessening of craft, just because of the sort of the protege aspect of things is really now, if you don't go out of your way to create it, you don't get it.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Comics is. I mean, well, comics, like any kind of pop art, popular art type stuff, changes over time. So that the you know, I remember seeing Will Eisner work when later in Will's career, really loved it, but always had that like 90s, 40s vibe to it. Always had looked like the stuff when he was young. I'm sure my stuff looks like that now to younger people, younger artists. They say, wow, old Simonson, still going, but really looks dated, looks really old. So, you know, and I can see some of what's been done. A lot of what's been done does not interest me particularly, at least as an artist. I mean, I'm glad those guys are doing it. I'm glad they're making a living at it. But I'm not as interested in creating work that looks like that as I am at creating the stuff I try to respond to myself. So far, I've been lucky enough to get work. That's kind of the measure of how that goes. You know, I may run the course one of these days where suddenly it's like, thanks a lot, Walter, for coming in, but we really can't use your stuff anymore. And so far, I'm good. But it is definitely an old school kind of approach to comics now.
There's to me, there was different types of comic book art, and one of the ways that in my head I looked at it, the actual art itself, is that there's art that seemed to be really kinetic. Like Jack Kirby's stuff seemed to just move across the page, and he wasn't going for photorealism, and it doesn't matter if hands aren't that shape, because that's, he's doing the impact and the visceral, the movement of it all. And then like on the other end of the spectrum to me was like Wally Wood, where everything just looked almost like this, this beautiful, stately, like frozen in time. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a real sort of stillness to it.
Yes.
That
the characters in flight had kind of a stop. You're catching this moment in time, but it's not a moving, you know, it doesn't moving in quite the same
way. It was like Botticelli, you know, it was like or, you know, the Sistine Chapel or something. And Kirby on the other end felt like it was almost like a courtroom sketch. Like, you know, like you're just capturing this courtroom sketch in a punch up, you know.
His work exploded off the page.
Yeah.
Really good. I mean, that's the stuff that I loved Woody's stuff, but I could never do it.
Right.
And Jack's stuff, I couldn't do Jack either, but I understood more of what he was doing in a way, where I aspired more to that look. So I I've said this elsewhere too, but what the heck. One of the things that I like in art is, how to describe this, in illustration coming out of Howard Pyle and the Brandywine School, the work those guys did, N.C. Wyeth and Schoonover and Dunn, there is a quality in their paintings where you see the painting and you see the picture, whether it's Bunker Hill or it's Robin Hood or it's King Arthur or whatever, the trapper in the wilderness. And you read the picture beautifully, you have no trouble with reading the picture. But you can also look at it maybe a little more closely and you see the surface of the paint of the drawing. And you're aware of the way the paint was laid on in order to make the sunlight happen over here. Or sometimes it's because it's thick, sometimes it's thinner, but you need Schaefer, but you still see the shape of the paint. So you're aware, or to me anyway, of both the three-dimensional quality of the picture and also of the two-dimensional quality of the canvas, because you're really looking at a flat surface that's giving you the illusion of depth. And I like work that has both those things going on. I think I was able to find to put that into words, or at least think about it. There was a million years ago, when we lived in New York City in 84, 85, 86, somewhere in there, there were a couple of giant Van Gogh shows. I'm sorry, Van Gogh, but Van Gogh, in the big museums in New York. I've forgotten which ones now even, but probably the MoMA, something like that. One was his up to Arles, one was later, one was a little bit earlier. But they were these giant career retrospectives. You could walk in, you just walk, and they had them all arranged chronologically. So you'd walk through them and see all this spectacular stuff. And you began to realize that nobody ever captured Van Gogh's stuff in reproduction. You see A Starry Night, it's like nothing that you've ever seen in a poster or a book, or just there's an electricity to it, a live quality that just doesn't exist in print. And they were spectacular. But one of the things that really blew me away, there was a hall somewhere, and there was a door in the center of it, like a room really. And there were two large drawings. And I would have said they were maybe a yard across and maybe 2 feet high. I don't remember for sure now. And they were of fields, and they were in pencil. They weren't paintings, they were pencil drawings. And the one I remember, high horizon, like a Bruegel horizon, and a lot of stubble in the field. The field's been cropped. I don't know if there were wheat haystacks in it or not. I can't remember. But the stubble, you know, was like larger in the foreground and became little dots in the background. And what you got when you step back from it, well, you clearly the field and you had the depth. I mean, less so than maybe color, because you're looking at black, you're aware of the black and white quality. But you're really aware of the mark of the pencil on the paper, on the surface of the paper. And it was really an epiphany for me, seeing the surface of the paper and the drawing of the field simultaneously. And in a sense, that's what I want my work to be. I want it to have, what I aspire to is the kind of energy Jack Kirby put into it. I'd love to do the guy who did the biggest space, a space inimical to man, is Philippe Drouillet, French artist.
Yeah.
And he just as these gigantic spaces with tiny people. And it just looks like the universe is so indifferent or maybe even malevolent toward man. It's just great. I've taken a lot from Drouillet when I could.
It's like a Kubrick. It's like a Kubrick film, like where you have the humanity like in a petri dish in the middle.
And they're just, so I want that. And I also want, my line to be both revealing of the depth in the drawing and at the same time revealing of the surface of the paper that I'm drawing on. I don't know that I always achieve that. Probably not. But that's what I'm looking for in the kind of line work that I do and the kind of way I approach the line that I want on in the art. I want it to be graphic. When I pencil something and then I ink it, I do not always ink exactly what I've already penciled. I mean, it'd be close, but I see the pencil as kind of an armature for my being able to be fairly free with the pen. Now, I've seen artists just be free with the pen with complete courage. That's not me. I have to have some pencil stuff down there so I can get my courage going. But that's really, you know, I might not draw the line exactly that way. I might go a little further out, or maybe it's thicker in that one spot. I don't draw my pencil lines like Starlin's pencil lines or other pencilers as well. Art Adams, I believe, where the pencil line itself is what's going to be in the ink line. It's thin at one end. It's thick in the middle. It thins out. He actually renders it up so you can see, the inker can see exactly how he wants it converted into ink. My stuff, since this isn't going to be a film, you won't be able to see it, but there's my pencil right there. It's a drafting pencil, a Pentel, I think it's a 209, and it's just an automatic lead. Just squirt the end of it, stick the lead out. So it's the same size all the time. I don't worry about how big my lines are in my pencil drawings because I'm going to do that when I start inking it, and I'll do it freeform. And in many cases, I talked to one of my friends once, Alan Milgram, we were talking about inking, and I think it was Alan, and he was indicating how, I mean, Alan was classically trained in a way. He went through studying at Murphy Anderson, one of the classic DC inkers. And if you had the underside of an arm, you would start a very thin line, for example, at the point of the elbow, under the tricep, very thin line, and you would draw the shape and then under the tricep and then back up to the armpit. And you'd make the line very thin at the elbow point, thick under the tricep, and then thin again at the far end, almost like a little bit of gravity is pulling your line down slightly. And I rarely think of it that way. I think of it mostly as almost as calligraphy. Like I'm doing drawing where I want the line to be alive, but I don't care about the gravity. I just want the line to create a drawing where the line itself speaks and renders the shape at the same time. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's as much as I shoot for. I don't think about it a lot, where at least not at this point. When I was first in comics, I thought about that stuff a great deal. I thought about page design a lot. I want my pages designed in a way that leads the eye through them. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I thought of pages as architecture, where you've got stuff up at the top and then you put stuff at the bottom, like a foundation, whether it's several big panels or vertical panels that will hold the rest of the page visually, stuff like that. Now, I just draw a page. Yeah. I don't worry so much about that stuff. But I can go back and look at it. If I analyze one of my pages, I can see that I've done a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I just like riding a bicycle. I learned how to do it, and you don't worry about balancing anymore. You just draw it.
Sure. You've asked that question, so the answer is already present in the work itself. You kind of accomplished that. It's interesting, the weight, the droop, and it seems like it's almost the difference between drawing the thing is kind of your way, and then the doing the line, and that's kind of drawing it in context of where it's at, like that's in an environment. Yours is almost more kind of like the kind of Renaissance approach of just you're painting the thing.
Well, I want all the drawing to be of the same, I don't know, the same world, the same
tactile
mindset in a way. So I mean, you do stuff. I did stuff, for example, this drawing of John Paul's that I did. The rocket men who are in the foreground are all outlined fairly heavily. They got a lot of black on them. I mean, I tried to emulate John Paul to a certain extent. He was just such a master of that kind of stuff. And then St. Basil's in the background is all line, no black, and it's all inked with a pretty thin pigment marker. So you have all these very bold shapes up in the foreground, and then this retreating into the background, almost like atmospheric perspective. where you have a thin line around all of St. Basil, all those damn tiles, all those onion domes, all that stuff. And so it sets back very nicely from all of these guys in the foreground. I'm kind of hoping to use some of that in the New Mutants so I don't screw it up. But we'll see how that, it will be an experiment for me for it. As I said, I'll do a few panels. My editor will be appalled to hear any of this stuff, I'm sure. Don't play this till I get the job done. But
your secret's safe. Your secret's safe with us.
You know, I have some ideas about doing it, which are a little different from what I normally do, and we'll see how they work out.
That's fantastic. Well, I as I said when we started this conversation, I've enjoyed your work for as long as I've enjoyed comics. I've been enjoying your comics, and and they're always executed with such grace. That would be the way I think of your storytelling and your art. It just looks lovely on the page. You know, you mentioned calligraphy.
Thank you very much.
It definitely comes across.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and maybe we can bother you again sometime. I have about a million more things.
Anytime you want to do it.
All right. Thanks for tuning into Mindspace. You just heard Jeff Boucher in conversation with Walt Simonson, a guest that we were thrilled to have, an absolutely wholesome and compassionate and kind, welcoming human being who, as you could probably tell, is extremely generous with tips and tricks, large and small.
And he's really good drawing Asgardians. Enough about the content of his character. What about his cartoons? No, I'm just joking. Yeah, Walter is the great Walt Simonson is a treat to talk to. And I wish people could see him talk, like as he was talking, because I think there's a in his mien, in his aura, it adds even more to things that he's saying, I think.
I loved his perspectives on history, whether it was Battle of Hastings or comics history that he lived through. And in our outro, I was thinking about what he said about the conditions of being a creator at Marvel in the 70s and 80s were so perfect in his experience. They allowed for personal connection with higher ups. You could just walk into offices, he said, and you know, you could make the case for your comics in person, and that it allowed for lots of strong bonds and friendships where, like he said, you go out to eat to the same restaurants. So I was thinking that we could talk about the industry conditions and the industry setup and what the infrastructure of different creative time periods does for the arts that's produced and that we might not recognize until later on, but kind of the environment is a character almost in the development of how art comes to us and what enables people to have the careers that they have.
Yeah, no, that's well said. I think that's it is an interesting topic. You look at, you know, we call them scenes, I guess, sometimes, but like in music, you know, it's the Seattle scene or the British Invasion or Tin Pan Alley, the Brill Building in New York with as the headquarters for songwriting for a couple generations of really, really talented lyricists and composers and how they affected each other. You know, like Neil Diamond was affected by the Brill Building and his career would not have been the career it was if he had not encountered that. Where you look at the
you're album. Talking to the biggest Beautiful Noise fangirl in the world. So
the what?
I know he has an epigraph to Tin Pan Alley on Beautiful Noise. So
yeah, it's sort of fascinating to think about. And I know I had it personally in a different way, in a different profession, but just being in the LA Times newsroom for 2 decades. And seeing the people that came through there, you know, I could have hit 5 Pulitzer Prize winners with a rock, except they security would have, you know, said stop throwing rocks, you know, kid. And you know,
that's just because you weren't in the environment of the Neolithic age. Then you would have been a warlord.
That's right. I'm much more of a Gutenberg era kind of.
I need
to have the equalizer of the printing press. You know, I'm a writer, not a fighter. But it's interesting, and I think that I kind of mourn the loss of newsrooms, and I am not someone that kind of bemoans the advancement of time and the change of. I think innovation is the only thing that change is the only thing that stays consistent. Everything's going to change always, and in the change there'll be great benefits and potential calamities, things that we don't anticipate both directions. But I can still be wistful for a certain moment in time, and I do fret about the quality of journalism and its watchdog capacity and things like that without the newsroom, because of just institutional amnesia. You know, I think it, with newspapers going the way of, you know, passenger rail, whatever, you know, hot air balloons maybe, that we see less local government coverage, you know, and less confrontational coverage. But on a personal level, as a writer, it's really hard to be improve yourself as a writer if you're not around editors and other writers. You know, it's like being no athlete that plays a team sport practices entirely alone. And essentially now writers kind of have to practice alone, unless they seek out and create their own community, which is what people are doing, and as they should. It's just different than what I've experienced, and I fear change and lash out against it.
Oh. Yeah, but like what about the physical environment? Can you give any specific examples of like what it felt like? Like what was the crackle in the air of, you know, what specific emotions did you feel that fueled your journalism and your career drive?
Well, for me, it was a lot of it was just the impulse to get approval. So, I mean, basically as kind of I like to procrastinate, I like to talk. So I'd walk around the newsroom and talk to people, and I would get these great stories from them. And in those stories, I was picking up cues about what, you know, this profession is and what it should be, what it isn't, you know, consciously and subconsciously picking that up. And, you know, it toughened me up. You know, there's times when it made me cry because it was so tough, you know, like people were harsh and, you know, I remember I covered a thing with a horse rescue, and the horse didn't make it. The horse died. And, but I had been with the family all day, and it was in this ravine, and they were flying it out by helicopter and putting this harness on it. And I had to go with them and hike for an hour, rappel down into this ravine with these Marines and on this precipice, you know, 500 feet above this gorge with this horse and harness, and these Marines risking their life to do this. And the helicopter comes and the cable gets electrified because of the rotors. And so now the Marines are like, this is a life-threatening operation. And then they whisk the horse away. And there's a lot of emotion and people are, you know, tears. This is like 8-9 hours into this adventure. And we're coming back down the mountain. We found out that the harness broke and that the horse had fallen like 10,000 feet. And that all this is for naught. And so now, and then it's just a really hurtful, harsh, you know, you can imagine all the emotions. And so I get back to the newsroom. And at the beginning of this day, when I started this horse rescue thing, I had a front page story with it. But it ended so sad that it got pushed inside. It was going to be my first front page story. It ended up on page like A26. And they put an Ethiopian famine photo on the front page. I'm like, oh, well, that's not sad. You know, but I understood the choice. I understood the choice totally. But I get back to my desk. You're asking about the texture of the experience there. I get back to my desk and I'm covered in dirt. My feet hurt. I'm from Florida. I've never seen a mountain. I've been in California 2 months, but I've been rappelling in sneakers today. So I'm just hurting all over. And I sit down at my desk and I have like 20 minutes to write a story to sum up everything that's happened during the day. The horse was named Scotch. That was the name of the horse. And I got back to my desk and somebody had played a joke on me. They had printed out a headline, like in the Times font, and put it across my computer screen. So it looked like I had a front page story and it said Scotch on the Rocks. And I started to cry. I actually started to almost like you don't understand, like, you know, like, is it really?
I'm so sorry.
I was so emotionally.
Really cruel.
I was so emotionally attached to everything that was going on and stuff. And I got up and I took a walk and I came back and an editor came over, it was a tough guy editor, and he put his hand on my shoulder and goes, "You all right?" I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Long day." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Just write it, make sure people know what happened. You got it." And he walked away. And that was exactly what I needed, because I was, before I saw the headline, I was a kind of too emotional the other direction. Mm-hmm. And then it pulled me back. And I actually needed that bucket of cold water in the face for a second, because it threw me off so much that I had to get up and walk away, but it took me out of the moment. And then, my editor was very reassuring and, helped me get through it. But it was a room full of like fascinating people and very strange people sometimes and idiosyncratic people, scary people, but all pushing toward the same thing. And that's exciting. That's what I think, Walt was talking about, is access to the gatekeepers and also just the mm-hmm. culture of it. Marvel, the Marvel bullpen never existed in reality the way it did in the comics. Portrayed in the comics often, not often, but frequently.
Can you just sum up like a glossary definition of the Marvel bullpen?
Oh yeah, sure. So when Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko started the Marvel Revolution with Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, right before that, Stan Lee was the only employee at Marvel, and the company had gotten so small that he was the one employee. And then they began to expand in the 60s once all these new superheroes started showing up, they were getting reader attention. And Stan really was great at presenting the underdog image of Marvel and getting that underdog energy. So he was constantly telling readers in the books, in the columns and the letters and the signs, editorials and stuff about how they were trying to take on DC and how they were the house of ideas, and that mm-hmm. they had the greatest group of creators in history, like Jack
like the house of wisdom in Baghdad and right. Medieval caliphate,
absolutely,
where science absolutely. Was born. That's so cool.
Absolutely. And he was always hyping it he was like a mix between Barnum, P.T. Barnum and Hugh Hefner, like creating a culture, just the same way Hefner did through a publication, Stan Lee did through Marvel Comics, and he presented
That's
all
so
these.
So smart, like your readers who are reading that and have this idea of your workplace, then they're not just going to get emotionally, parasocially attached to your characters, they're going to get attached to you, things with your name on it, they're going to want to work for you.
That's why everybody calls Stan Lee the man. Stan the man. Everybody, he's everybody's first favorite writer. He's the writer everybody's mm-hmm. knew first. Like before I knew Shakespeare, yeah. I knew Stan Lee. But he was very intuitive. Of kind of had a huckster energy to it, and he mixed it with kind of a '60s kind of jive, and it was mocked much. It was much mocked and parodied. One of the parodies was DC Comics presented a version of Stan, called it Funky Flashman.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, purely a lot of a bile in that that portrayal. But in creating this persona and all these different creators, nickname for every single artist, Stan was creating the image of this place. It's like, it was like Algonquin or like maybe the Knights of the Round Table. And it's where everybody came together. The reality of it was a little less glamorous and wasn't nearly as hectic. The people that were in the Marvel offices most often weren't necessarily the artists. Jack Kirby worked in his home in the basement. But a lot of people went there seeking this, it's like going to Graceland,
Yeah, or Mecca, or, yeah.
Yeah, like it's the Willy Wonka chocolate factory. I want to get in there. What's it look like inside? It's, a lot of people made the pilgrimage. Fellini famously stopped by. Curious people, Uri Geller, who was a mentalist who would mm-hmm. use his mental powers to bend spoons.
Yeah.
He went by, and he was in an issue of Daredevil. He teamed up with Daredevil as a result. Bent the Spoon, I guess, you know, as you do. Kiss went by there, the band Kiss, you know, they did the famous deal with Marvel when Marvel published their comics. The band members cut themselves so they could bleed into the ink, so they could say that their blood was in every issue of the Kiss comic book, which was just brilliant as far as like marketing, like on brand.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, those guys are, they can't play musical instruments, but they really know how to sell stuff.
In this whole Marvel bullpen, I'm guessing there wasn't a health inspector.
You know, yeah, no.
At least a nurse on site for ritual bloodletting.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll tell you though, that talk about on brand.
I'd want to work. Maybe if, you know, they didn't make me do that on my first day, but a kind of workplace that's open to that, I'd be like, hey.
Oh, it'll be interesting to see how things move forward, how people replace that sense of community and stuff. I mean, the mentorship and the North Star quality of being around people that do what you want to do.
Yeah, you've been researching, and doing projects during quarantine. I'm not sure if we should still call this era quarantine. I don't know what to call it. The extended homestay. Have you noticed a difference? Has it been difficult for you?
It's been phenomenally difficult because the collaborative aspect of it and the auditioning aspect. You know, I would walk around the newsroom, and you know, I started there. I was 21 years old, and I worked there for 21 years, and I would read my lead. I would recite it to people, and they would say something, and I would go back and I'd fix it. And I just, by the time I made it from one end of the newsroom to the other, I had finished the story because every single person told me, and they didn't know, well, maybe they did. I didn't know that I was doing that. It just kind of happened because I would get nervous energy and start walking around. You know, now there's no place to walk and there's nobody to talk to. So I just sort of, I just sit there and kind of grind the gears, and it's a lot less writing. It is no longer enjoyable because of it. It was like a social activity for me, you know.
Yeah, and it sounds really great because you can have the best of both worlds of getting up and kind of stretching your legs and taking a break and like not working, but also you are also working.
Yeah, that's right. And
now work just feels like work all the time.
That's right. And it was a tough room, you know. Like, I mean, some really great people in there. Like, you know, there was like four people that won Pulitzer Prizes that I sat next to. You know, clearly I'm bringing the curve down of the newsroom. But one of them has actually got a new movie coming out. J.R. Moeringer got a new movie with George Clooney coming out about his childhood. A movie adapting a book about growing up in a bar, the Tender Bar instead of the Bartender.
Mm-hmm.
But we should see if we get JR on the show. I haven't talked to him for years, but one of the three or four best writers I ever worked with. Just a phenomenal talent.
Definitely. So, that would be super cool.
It was just fun just having access to people like that and crusty people. And there was an old cops reporter who had a clip-on tie that he kept tacked to the wall. So if he had to go to court, he could just grab it, stick it on. And he would leave with a soda in his back pocket, and he would sit down and he would use his rather substantial belly as a table. In court, he would just put the notebook right on top of it and just start taking notes with his soda in his back pocket and his clip-on tie, if he remembered it. And, you know, it's just fantastic characters. It was like David Runyon, kind of the textures of it were great. I love it. If anybody ever wants to publish a book about newsrooms, I'm your guy.
Yeah, it's been weird because, you know, all of my jobs have been during quarantine, so I kind of don't know anything else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm grateful that I can be in the middle of the country and work in publishing, as I know a lot of people are getting into the industry. But at the same time, I think things are going to inevitably go back. I think another thing that people romanticize about 70s, 60s, you know, pre-now New York and working in the comics and publishing there is that the rent wasn't so expensive. Like I love the stories Harlan Ellison would tell of, you know, running to the pulps, getting a story, hammering it out in one night, and he's got all his rent money, he can go buy pizza.
Yeah.
And that just seems just totally bizarre to me. Like, you could afford rent with one day of, well, grueling, but, you know, intense work. I'd do that in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's a real good point. And there's all kinds of trade-offs and different things. You know, I mean, crime was so much more a really fearsome part of people's life back then too. But New York has certainly changed a lot. It will continue to do so. But it's, I think it's dangerous to be overly nostalgic or to fight the changing times. But I'm kind of glad that I got at least the tail end of that newsroom era. Mm-hmm. It really suited my sensibilities, my rhythm.
It's always good to hear from you and Walt. You know, we try to give our listeners different cross sections of all sorts of eras in history. So I think we've covered a broad reach today.
Absolutely. And I love the conversations about creativity and how it's changing. I think it's actually really useful to people. So
he had so many tips that were so, you know, small but so evident. Like, as we were talking, I was doing that line thing with the forearm. I was trying to draw an arm, and I was like, this is very handy.
yeah I love stuff like that. I love that too. Like, just there's a book called How to Draw Marvel Comics Way that came out in the 70s.
Yeah
And I used to sit and study that. I love the tricks of the trade.
My comics club in college, we had one copy of that book. And circles would form around it during our meetings, you know, as people were all trying to get reference images and just read it. It was a kind of, again, you talk about Stan Lee's appeal. It's just this extremely fun artifact.
Absolutely.
It was almost like an Indiana Jones type, you know, everyone was just in its glow.
That's great.
It did have a glow. It had a young, happy, scrappy glow.
There's another book like that called, well, it's different, but Marvel put out, called the Marvel Fumetti book. I think I might be saying that wrong. But Fumetti is when you put words on photographs, like captions.
Yeah.
There was a joke book about the Marvel bullpen and about all the people that were part of it. And I'll see if I can track it down and I'll show it to you. You get a kick out of it if you like the Marvel art. You would love this.
Yeah, because that comes from Italian. Like, they're you know, the fum, the air, the kind of smoke, is that's how the bubbles
in
comics are drawn. So
I think you're exactly right. And the cover of this is Dr. Doom, but he's got his face plate off, his mask, and it's Stan Lee underneath. And he looks kind of like Groucho Marx. What more could you want from that?
I don't know.
So, but we'll see you next time. That was a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.